Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Stack Trace. I say really welcome back there because we know it's been a while, but we are really excited to record the show again and are excited for you to listen to it as well. My name is John Sandell, and I am, of course, joined, like always, by my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Mr. Rambo?
Is this thing on? Hello?
Does it still work? I did actually have to check my audio equipment before we joined the call here, just to make sure that everything was still working after a bit of a hiatus, if you will.
Yeah, I'm still podcasting regularly, so I still know that all my stuff works. However, I am always afraid that I'm going to turn on the mic and try to talk to you and that I will have forgotten how to speak English because I haven't been speaking that much lately. So it's good to get the practice on.
Yeah, absolutely. Because all the other podcasts you do for your podcast network, they're all in Portuguese, right?
Right, correct.
Makes sense. I haven't forgotten. I still have, you know, client meetings and everything in English. Plus, you know, here at home, we speak like three languages, Swedish, Polish, and English, like all mixed every single day. So it's that's the only danger, I guess, for me is that I will all of a sudden start saying some words in Swedish or Polish. But other than that, I think we're good to go.
Good to go.
So maybe we should just like quickly address, like, because we have gotten quite a lot of messages from people, like what's going on with the show, how come there's no new episodes of Stack Trace, what's going on with Swift by Sundell, and so on. And, you know, I think we've mentioned it before that once we kind of stop doing the show on a regular basis and once we kind of stopped having sponsors and these sorts of things, we just started treating the show more like a hobby project and just something we do kind of when we have time and when we feel like we have something interesting to talk about that is not just kind of updating you on the tech news. Because if we do a podcast like once every 2 months or something, like talking about the news is not really that relevant, right? It's more interesting then to talk about like learnings from our personal projects and development and talk about programming topics in general and so on. So that's kind of what we're focusing on. And, you know, we've mentioned then that, you know, the show is becoming a lot more irregular as a result. And we know that for the past few months, it's been a bit too irregular, I would say. We haven't done many episodes. And we do want to try getting back to doing episodes more frequently. But like we say, life gets in the way, right? Like we have so many other things that we're working on and that's going on. And it's sometimes hard to find a time where we can both sit down and record an episode. And not just record the episode, but also have time to edit it and make sure we have a good show. Because we also don't want to do a show just for the sake of it. Like, we want to do something that we feel proud of and something that we think was a good discussion and that people will enjoy listening to. So that's kind of why there's no, like, we haven't gotten tired of doing the show or we don't want to do it anymore. And, like, Swift by Sundell is not canceled and Stack Trace is not canceled. It's just that, you know, we have so many other things to work on and we do hope to release more episodes and to do it as often as we can, but sometimes there might just be a few months where not much is going on. But don't worry, there will be a new episode until we officially say that, you know, the show is canceled, which we hope will never happen, or at least maybe happen when we're super old. I don't know.
Right, yeah. Rest assured, if we ever decide to not do the show again, we will let everyone know. So don't worry. Yeah. If it's been a while since the last episode, doesn't mean we've given up. It's just irregular, but we are keeping the show on and we'll keep going until we officially cancel it, and then we'll let you know. Don't worry.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just said there that we're not going to talk about the news, but since we are right now before WWDC 2024, I thought it would be a good kind of topic to start with here, to just do a little bit of a check-in around how are we feeling about this year's WWDC. Like, are you hyped, Rambo? Are there any expectations you have? Any wishes? Like, how are you feeling about the conference this year?
Yeah, I think it's been a while since there was a WWDC I was looking forward to this much. And that's mainly because I have been doing quite a lot of stuff around AI, which we will definitely talk more about soon. And we, especially with Chibi Studio, we've been doing lots of prototyping around different ideas and things we can leverage generative AI for. And we haven't shipped any of those yet. And that's because I'm worried that we'll have like this whole thing based on like an OpenAI API or something similar. And then come iOS 18, there will be built-in stuff that we could leverage instead. And then we'll have all of this cloud-based stuff that, we worked on and that's not based on that and that costs a lot of money and things like that. So we're kind of waiting to see what comes out at WWDC in order to decide, like, if we realize that we can't do much with what Apple announces, then we'll just ship what we have based on third-party APIs. But if there's at least one thing we can leverage from whatever Apple announces at DubDub, then we'll probably work on that and then ship it later this year and keep working with what's built in, because I think that's going to be a big advantage if we can figure out ways to use what Apple is going to provide on device or on Apple's own cloud services rather than going with these third parties.
Yeah, absolutely. Because we have seen, especially in recent years, kind of some of the dangers of building against a third-party API with things like, you know, the Reddit API, the Twitter API, and so on, like either shutting down or becoming really expensive or hard to use in other ways. And those are just some examples. And those kinds of things happen, maybe not all the time, but they do happen, right? It's not impossible. That is a real concrete risk that you're always taking when you're incorporating some kind of server-based third-party component into an application. And especially if you're treating it as like a really core part of the application, which, you know, the features that you've been talking about and you've been showing to me that you're building, it seems like they are mostly additive to the products, like for Chibi Studio and so on. Yeah. But still, you want them to work and you want them to be maintainable going forward. And you probably want to keep expanding them and making them even bigger parts of the applications going forward. And then it makes total sense, I think, to be very careful about, you know, what kind of technology am I incorporating? Because especially with things like AI, it feels like it's changing so incredibly quickly, even by like technology standards. Yeah. You know, we're used to a new version of iOS coming out every year and a new version of Swift coming out multiple times per year and things changing and we're having to update our code bases and relearn things and so on. But with AI, like this modern iteration of like generative AI basically didn't exist a few years ago. Like it's so new and it's still being iterated on so quickly that I absolutely understand your hesitation to kind of lock yourself in to a third-party vendor, especially when, you know, Apple are very likely to release something AI related in just a month, all right?
Yeah, and I imagine it's probably not going to be the case where we can just drop everything we have and go full in on Apple stuff. But if we get a good vision from Apple on what they've been working on and we get a sense that it's going to keep improving year over year or even within individual OS releases, then I think it's something where we can wait a little bit more and ship less than what we've got currently with the third-party providers, but in a way that's more sustainable going forward and that we know that at least Apple is not going to cut out the API without notice or start charging $1 million per month for the API, even though I know they would love to, but
services revenue.
Exactly. At least in terms of APIs, that's not how they usually do things. So yeah, I think if this was like a year ago and we had all of this cool stuff with third parties built and ready to ship, we could like ship it and take advantage of the hype and like the gold rush. But I think the gold rush is kind of over in the AI space. Not fully done yet, but there's still some stuff coming out that I feel like is gold rushy. But I think the main meat of the gold rush where you could, and I'm doing scare quotes here, just release an AI app and get $1 million, I think that's over. So I think we can afford to basically just wait and see.
Yeah, and I think another key component was something that you mentioned earlier that I think a lot of people, us included, are expecting, at least to a large extent, Apple's AI implementations and models to be local and be running on device because they have been investing so much in Core ML, the neural engines in all their devices, and so on to kind of set up this infrastructure for on-device AI. And, you know, they've been talking about it quite a bit. It's funny how Apple, they seem to now have fully embraced the AI lingo, where before they were always saying like on-device intelligence or on-device machine learning. It seems like now it's like, okay, it's all AI, right? So everybody knows what we're talking about. And that also is a key component, right? Because then you are not relying on servers, you're not relying on those kind of subscription costs and you as a developer taking that on, but rather it being distributed on your users' devices. And that has, of course, privacy aspects, and that's, I'm sure, something Apple will emphasize a lot when they talk about it at WWDC, but also like cost. There's a lot of cost implications there as well, and maybe it's going to be a lot simpler for you as a developer to implement when you're already building apps for Apple's platforms. So that's, I think, something also that is something I would definitely keep in mind when making these decisions.
Right, and I think the cost side of things is interesting when you think about Apple, because that might be the way they differentiate their offerings from others. Because realistically, unless they've got something hidden that we never heard about and there were never any rumors or leaks, they are not going to have stuff that's significantly better than, say, ChatGPT and things like that. It's probably not going to be as advanced, especially if it runs on device. Like, it's not like you can do a GPT-4 level model on device. That's not currently possible.
I would even have the expectation that it would be considerably worse, because right. It seems like, unless, like you say, they've been really working in some secret lab on this for years, they are quote-unquote behind, it seems like. It seems like they are showing up a little bit later to the race, if you will. And that's not to say like Apple is doomed or anything, but it's just that they will be earlier in that iteration phase. So they will probably have something that is less capable. But yeah, like you're saying, if it runs on device, that is a differentiating factor.
Yeah. And at least in terms of LLMs, right? Specifically on the LLM side of things, they have some papers that came out that are interesting, and they have even an open source model they released a couple of weeks ago. And from what people are saying, they are not, of course, as good as the other stuff that's out there. But again, if you can run on device, that's definitely a differentiating factor. But then comes the partnership aspect. And there has been rumors of Apple is in talks with Google and OpenAI and things like that. So if Apple offers a cloud-based solution, even if it's mainly just a proxy to these other services, they could maybe have cost as a differentiating factor, even if they lose some money in the short term, where they kind of subsidize these APIs to their developer ecosystem in a way that, say, apps on iOS or the Mac or other Apple platforms can offer advanced cloud-based AI solutions at a more affordable price, because Apple is basically subsidizing parts of it, at least for now. Apple has a lot of money, famously, so maybe if they can't win on how much better or how good their models are, maybe they can subsidize usage of these more advanced models by leveraging some of that pile of money that Tim Cook has under his mattress or something.
Yeah, that must be a very big mattress, very thick mattress, if that's going to be the case. Yeah, I agree. And maybe it can even be something like a hybrid solution where you as the developer, maybe you either have control of it or you by default just ask for inference into a specific model with specific parameters, and leveraging technologies like async await, you would just await on the response and maybe it will resolve it locally or go to the cloud depending on what the query is and what the nature of the thing you're asking for is. Like, I can totally see them doing a lot of generative AI things on device, while if you're asking for some kind of knowledge-based question or something about the news or something, it might actually go off and fetch that from the internet, because your device, of course, cannot cache all of the information from the whole internet on device, but it can probably cache like information and models related to generating text in specific languages and so on, right?
Yep.
Like maybe the most popular languages or the languages that you have set on your device. So if your phone is in Brazilian Portuguese, for example, then maybe it has that cached locally. But then if you're asking for something in Swedish or Spanish or something, it has to go to the cloud. Like, I can see them create something like that where perhaps from our perspective as third-party developers, we're just asking it for a prompt, or we're giving it a prompt, but how it resolves that prompt is kind of, you know, dynamic.
Right, and we already have some APIs that work like that. One that came to mind is the speech recognition API. So you can have it basically transcribe some audio for you, and it can do that on device, but depending on the settings, it will go and do it on the cloud on your behalf. And it's exactly like you mentioned, it's just an asynchronous API, and you don't even have to know if it's going to the network or not, but you do have control. There is like a flag you can set to say, basically, I only want this processing to happen on device, which I think they would probably do as well if they did something like you mentioned, so that if I have maybe privacy concerns or some other type of concern that I don't want this stuff to go to the cloud no matter what, then you could just say, hey, do this on device. And then, of course, it wouldn't be as good, but you know what you're doing at that point, and then you can opt into having it go to the cloud or not.
Right, exactly. And maybe there's even something where using Apple's favorite API, the one API to rule them all, NS user activity.
Oh, no.
They can do something where perhaps they can like train models based on app data, app contents, but in a completely like anonymous private way. And then when you download an app, you also download like an extension to that model specific for that app, which means that you will be able to ask it things about that app without having to like train it yourself, or without it having to learn it like on device, relearn it and so on. Right. Like I can see a lot of kind of hybrid solutions like that, where they could enable a lot of local AI features, but without having to always go to the cloud for every single request.
Yeah, exactly. And also something like what the Rabbit R1 device is trying to do, not very successfully at the moment based on what we've seen from the reviews and whatnot, but the idea is very interesting, where you train this action model and it can use websites and apps without having knowledge of APIs that it can call in order to do things. So you could think of something like, what if you could automate apps on your iPhone without the app having to explicitly support, say, shortcuts and things like that? So basically what would be happening is the system behind the scenes would be actually opening the app and tapping buttons and doing stuff, and you don't have to like record a macro like you would do with some automation apps on the Mac and things like that. You can just have a model that knows how to use a user interface as a user would, and you could automate things that way. Because the main issue with automation on iOS and iPadOS is that apps have to support it. And unfortunately, the APIs to support it have never been that good. And now they're getting better. They're still not very good, but they're way better than the list files, like the shortcuts definition files you had to use before. But there's still a long ways to go for them to be something that developers can just implement really easily and not worry too much about details, which unfortunately is the case right now. So if they could use a model that would just use the app as a user, that would be very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think here, again, there's some interesting kind of technological opportunities where, since Apple controls the OS and they know a lot more about an application than something like a Rabbit R1, which is just interacting through a VPN or something, through a website and clicking buttons, right? Like, which is like a very opaque way to train an AI like that. But if you have like insight into what does the view hierarchy look like, what are some of the accessibility attributes, we have things like NS user activity, like I mentioned earlier. And you could even imagine there being some feature in Xcode where you as a developer could even train actions as you are like QA testing your app or developing the app. And you could say, Xcode, just observe what I'm doing here now and just learn from it, right? So as you are like working on your UI, or as a QA tester is testing the UI, then the model just keeps learning, or the AI system keeps learning. And then again, it can kind of generate some extension file or something that can then be ingested by the system and then extend the action model to be able to perform actions for that specific application. Or it could be like crowdsourced from users because, again, Apple has insight in not just at what point on the screen something is being tapped, but what is actually being tapped because they're running the run loop inside of the application. They're running the event loop. They know what control is here. Even if it's a completely custom control, it's going to be a Swift UI view or it's going to be a UIKit view and so on. So I feel like there's a lot of cool things that could happen here and really enable some like transformative things for users too. Because like you mentioned, like having to either write your own automation using a limited set of like automation dictionaries or something, or having to just record taps at specific positions and things like that. Like those things will always be quite fragile and kind of be just a secondary system to interacting with the app by itself.
Yeah.
But something like this could presumably be just like interacting with the app, just in a kind of completely headless way where the app is not, the UI is not being launched or anything to you as the user. And you could just ask it to, you know, set a reminder or, you know, order something in an app that doesn't actually have direct integration with the personal assistant, but you're just doing it anyway through that model, which I think is pretty exciting.
Right, because if you think about it in a simple way, you could do it like you mentioned, just like record a macro where just tap the specific points on screen where the user is tapping and then record that as a set of actions and then just repeat it later. But of course, that's fragile, like you mentioned, because if a button was on the right and then it's on the left, or there's a new button to the sides, and that breaks very quickly. Then you can be more fuzzy and maybe like instead of using the position of controls, you actually look at accessibility attributes of those controls, but those can also change. So it's not very good to just do like a straight comparison. But even then, like, what if the app throws up a App Store review dialogue in the middle of your automation? Is your automation going to handle that? So that's the sort of thing where having a machine learning model do that, I think, can address those tricky situations, which are not even edge cases, because like every app at some point is going to pop up an App Store review dialogue. And if your automation can't handle that, it's going to break when that inevitably happens.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we've seen in recent years, like the application of AI models, when you have that additional metadata that we're talking about here, can be just incredibly powerful. Like one thing that I really enjoy using is NVIDIA's DLS technology, like deep learning supersampling for games, where game developers, they're integrating this technology into their games and it does upscaling using AI, but it's not just taking a low resolution image and just like stretching it up to a higher resolution. It's also using like game engine data, like motion vectors and color data and things like that over time. And the result then is like really incredible. Like sometimes an upscaled image can look better than if you just rendered it natively.
Wow.
Because you also get like things like anti-aliasing, you get like lots of artifact removal and so on. Of course, there are still some artifacts that can be introduced, but I would say overall, even if you zoom in on a picture that's been upscaled, it can look incredibly good. And I feel like this is something that could also be applied in these other fields that we're talking about, where when you combine the just like kind of learning aspect of like doing these many, many iterations and training these neural networks with that additional metadata that is coming directly from the application, you can just achieve like very, very good results with very few kind of false positives.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. So that's the AI part of WWDC. Anything else that you're excited about or anticipating?
Well, that's a good question, actually. there has been some talk about a more customizable home screen for iOS, at least. And that sounds interesting to me. I'm not big into super customizing everything about the device, but I'm interested in seeing what that actually means in practice, and also if that happens, what we as developers will be able to do to facilitate that, and maybe there will be a second coming of widgets that happened when they first introduced widgets and people went crazy with the widget customizations and things like that. So I'm really interested in seeing where that goes, and I know that, for example, the whole wallpaper system on both lock screen and home screen on iOS is based on extensions using the extension kit APIs. So I wonder, would they maybe allow developers to offer wallpapers to the system? I think that could be really interesting, where, say, Chibi Studio, you could create your own wallpapers using your creations in the app and things like that. So I'm interested in seeing how far they go with those customizations.
Yeah, and I think a theme, if you look at what's been going on in the most recent years, like the major features that have been introduced on iOS specifically, it has been a lot about system integration.
Yep.
And it's been a lot about this idea that we've actually been talking about for years, not that we invented it or something, like Apple listen to Stacktrace and that's why we have all of this stuff. No, not at all. But I think we've been really wanting the whole kind of operating system to become a bit more like different plugins. And that's really what we have with this extension architecture, where there's so many more integration points now into the system, and you can really build an app where the app itself is mostly just a setting screen.
Yeah.
And then it just integrates through widgets and all these other ways with the operating system to just provide functionality kind of in the background. And this, I think, is super cool. And especially as we're moving more towards this kind of idea of ambient computing, where, you know, you have data being kind of fed to you without having to explicitly ask for it. So instead of having to launch an app and do a task, you can just do something like through the personal assistant on the device, or maybe something pops up automatically, like proactively, which we're already seeing with suggestions in Spotlight and suggestions on the home screen and so on, and smart notifications. So that I find very, very exciting. And I think like having some of that stuff also come to the home screen there with wallpapers, like you talk about, where you don't just, you're not just able to vend like an image, but something more like with layers and different metadata that the system can then use to render this in a very cool way. Like, I think that all of that stuff is just really, really cool. And the more iOS, I feel like, can become this just like kind of series of plugins that all plug together, and that's the end user experience. You get like really good customizability. You get the third-party app opportunity to be more integrated into the platform and to be able to offer more functionality. I think it's just all great.
Yeah, and what's cool is that they've been developing this whole infrastructure for quite a while, at least since iOS 8, where you can do all of that stuff and still retain all of the privacy and security aspects of the system. That's why so many of these things take so long, that there's both that aspect and also like battery life and things like that. So it's interesting that they could technically achieve that and still maintain all of the expectations about security and privacy and all of that good stuff.
Yeah, and this is where also we've talked about it before, but like the whole idea of declarative programming, whether it's in the context of Swift UI or whether it's in the context of you handing a function to the system that gets run, that you don't just, your app is not just woken up in the background and you just get your app delegate callback and then you can run whatever code you want, but something that is more constrained. That has so much potential when it comes to this kind of architecture, and we've already seen it being deployed for things like widgets, where, you know, you as the app developer, you provide like a timeline of snapshots to the system that the system can then render over time. And I can also see similar things with the previous thing we talked about with the AI stuff. Like if you're able to vend like a Swift function to the system that is not just arbitrary Swift code, but it uses some kind of DLS, like domain specific language, similar to Swift UI, to kind of build up building blocks around some kind of prompt or query. And then that can be kind of serialized and run in the background whenever the system has some excess capacity, and it can be delivered like in a very smooth way and very efficient way. Like, I feel like that is also building blocks that have been put together over a few years, and also has a lot of potential, and was also very interesting from a technical point of view.
Yeah.
So from my perspective, I feel like I'm just going in with an open mind. Like, I don't have so many expectations when it comes to like system features. Of course, I expect AI to be a big focus, like we talked about. But more than that, I feel like I'm really hoping that this will be a year where Apple will address some kind of long-running stability issues with their developer tools.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically what I'm talking about is things like the, you know, with Xcode and the integration with the Swift compiler, integration with the debugger and so on. And, you know, I had this joke that I used to make, like, it wasn't much of a joke, actually. It was pretty much the truth. But it was pretty much like every WWDC, I would say, my wish list for this year is just, you know, an Xcode with a very stable editing experience and everything just works. And, you know, that continues to be kind of my number one wish. And I realized that Xcode is a very complex beast, and it has probably a lot of legacy code in there, and that the teams that are working on this are doing the best they can to kind of make things better. And things are getting better. I think, for example, the new build system that was introduced a few years ago has been a huge kind of positive improvement, right, to the overall experience of using Xcode. Like, now the build tasks are a bit more predictable, faster. Things like dependency management with Swift Package Manager integration is better. Like, things are improving, and we're getting fewer and fewer of those like source kit crashes. It's just when I'm like really deep into generics, I usually get them. But other than that, like, usually things are working pretty well. But what I'm mostly talking about is, for example, I think one issue that's been plaguing Xcode now for at least like 2 or 3 years are these ghost errors. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've seen them as well, right?
Oh, yeah. I was experiencing this yesterday, and it's really annoying.
Yeah, and it's like these things happen when Xcode will surface some build error that you fixed like 2 days ago, but it will still be in the cache. Yeah. And even if you like clean drive data and do all the classic tricks, it still is there. And I know that caching is one of the hardest problems in computer science, or cache invalidation, I should say. And this is definitely an issue of cache invalidation, it looks like. But this is just one example of like the tools seem like kind of a little bit too decoupled in a way. And I'm not talking about like the good sense of decoupling where you have decoupled systems, but more that one tool doesn't know what the other one is doing, right? Where Xcode as the IDE, like, there's something in the build system there that hasn't really been surfaced up to the editor. And similar things with, you know, syntax highlighting and auto completion, I still think could use a lot of improvements. And this is where, you know, I'm excited about all this AI stuff. And one thing that I am expecting also to come to Xcode, maybe this year even, is some kind of copilot feature.
Right.
But I feel like the more they add these kinds of features, the more kind of pressure it puts on the core editing experience of the IDE to the point where it easily breaks.
Yeah.
And we've seen this many times in the past where as soon as, you know, a new feature comes along, whether it's like Xcode previews for Swift UI or, you know, when Swift was introduced and so on, like the Xcode stability takes a big hit. And I'm really hoping that they have not just like added a bunch of features this year, but also worked on the core editing experience, because I feel like that at this point, you know, Swift is going to turn 10 years this year. I feel like this stuff just needs to be rock solid.
Yeah.
Like, it needs to be similar to when they had that problem with the butterfly keyboards on the MacBooks, where, you know, sometimes you type a key and you get two letters or no letter at all. Like, that cannot happen. And I feel like the same thing is true for the IDE, where when you're writing your code, when you're building your code, when you're testing it, debugging it, you cannot have any false positives. So you cannot have any positive negatives. Like, it all needs to be the reflection of reality. Like, I don't want to see build succeeded and then there are compiler errors, because then I stop trusting the tools. And similarly, when the tools say that there are compiler errors that I fixed 2 days ago, also really erodes a lot of trust in the tools, right?
Yeah.
So I'm really hoping that this will also be a year of stability fixes, and that the core editing experience of Xcode will just keep getting better to the point where it feels like really, really solid, which I really don't think we're there yet.
If I was in charge of Xcode for a while, like, let's say I've become the Xcode manager for a month or something, my rule would be you cannot add any AI to this thing until I can type and the letters appear with at least as low of a latency as Visual Studio Code, which is an Electron app. And for some reason, sometimes, especially in larger projects, just typing in Xcode is really slow. And like sometimes it will lag, and it feels like it takes like almost a second for a letter to appear. So please fix that before you try to integrate an AI into this thing. Because I feel like if they integrate AI into it, it's just going to get worse.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, that's what I'm talking about. Like, input lag is like the most core of core features, yeah, right? And have you tried, there's a new text editor, which is called Zed. Have you tried that, Rambo?
I have not.
So I would say I don't know if I would recommend it as an Xcode user, because once you try it, like you really notice how bad Xcode is in terms of input lag. Like, because they advertise it as being like way faster than even Visual Studio Code, which we say even, and we're saying that's an Electron app, which again, a native app should be faster than an Electron app, I would say. Like, that's one of the trade-offs you make when you go cross-platform like that is, you know, usually things like native integration, such as input lag, suffers. But I think the teams working on Visual Studio Code have done just an amazing job, because it's just an incredible editor. Like, it's just so good. And it's one of the Electron apps where I'm not constantly reminded that it's Electron, because it's so good, you know? But that being said, like, a native app, especially a native app coming from Apple that also makes macOS, should just have so little input lag that it should just be the fastest editor on the market, right? Yeah. Like, that should be the gold standard, but it's not. Like, Xcode's input lag is just horrendous, I would say. Like, it's really, really slow at just rendering characters. And then again, that is a really, really core feature. Like, we are excited about AI. We're excited about cool refactoring features with animations that fold your code into origami. That's very, very nice. But just make the letters appear on the screen in a predictable way first, right? Like, fix the core fundamentals first before you add more high-level features is usually sound advice. And I think I'm hoping that this is something that has been prioritized by Apple this year, because Xcode is a pretty good editor, I would say, a pretty good IDE overall. It has a lot of good features, and it's nice and easy and nice to use and pleasant to use. But it's, again, it's the fundamentals that I think could use a lot of polish and optimization.
Yeah, like whenever I'm doing one of these little prototypes where I just go file new project and it's a small project, it works perfectly. Like, it's really good. I really love the experience overall. It's when you get a real life project opened that you start facing these issues. Although there is one aspect that I also wish they would fix, which is the way the devices are integrated into Xcode, which changed with the iOS 17, basically the iOS 17 train introduced this new core device framework and protocol, where you can basically have your devices communicate with Xcode seamlessly, no matter whether it's plugged in or wireless. You don't have to configure something separate in order for them to work wirelessly, which I think is good. And also, the experience of using devices wirelessly has improved tremendously with this new system.
Yeah. It's so much better, to the point where I'm actually using it now.
Yeah, exactly. However, it's not always good. And the main issue that I have at the moment is that often I will have my device plugged in, but it will use the wireless connection instead. So it's bad at basically switching from wireless to wired. And I'm not saying like in the middle of a debug session, like I wouldn't expect that to work, but sometimes, like, I have a test device, I plug it in, I build and run, and it takes longer than it should. And there's also another thing that happens with wireless debugging in Xcode, where the first frame of the app, basically, on screen, it takes a few seconds to start responding. And so when I want really fast iteration, I plug in the device, and sometimes it'll still use the wireless connection. So basically, I have gotten into the habit of turning off Wi-Fi on the device, then plugging it in, starting the debug session, and then after it's established, I can then go and turn it back on. And also, because it's basically no longer configurable whether a device should work wirelessly or not, all of your devices are always there in Xcode, and I have a lot of devices. I know most developers maybe don't have as many test devices as I do, but I do. And sometimes I notice that Xcode is doing like a lot of stuff behind the scenes with every single device you can find nearby. And I've even experienced like crashes in Xcode where I look at the crash and it's in like the core device thread where it was trying to talk to like my iPad that's upstairs, and I'm not even debugging on that iPad. I'm not doing anything about that iPad, but it crashed because something broke in the communication. So yeah, I wish they would make that basically give us more control over this communication with devices.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like sometimes also Xcode kind of falls victim to the curse of distributed systems, which is that, you know, Xcode is definitely a very distributed system. Like the core device framework you just talked about is definitely like a subcomponent. Even if I haven't seen the source code for Xcode at all, we kind of can see from the stack traces in the crash reports and just from how Xcode operates in general, like everything is its own little service, its own little subsystem that is running. And usually the problem when you have something like that, like you're working on a project that is distributed like that or very modularized, like we usually talk about that from the good aspect, right? Like it's really nice to have things being separated out into separate modules and to have the interfaces between them be very well defined and have separation of concerns. Like those are all great things. But when we're talking about a big project that is worked on presumably by a lot of people, you can sometimes end up with this issue where every subsystem is kind of optimized to do what it does without much concern about what the other systems are doing. And I talked a little bit about this before when we talked about the problem with the build system and the IDE UI not being quite in sync. But you can imagine being the developer, for example, working on the device management code and, you know, thinking, you know, it would be a great idea to just kind of in the background, asynchronously, just make sure all the devices are up to date, download the symbols from them, you know, ensure that the they're set up for development so that when the user goes and select the iPad in the list and they press run, they just runs immediately. Like that is a good idea in general by itself, right? Yeah. To do things proactively, to make things faster when the user wants it. But if you then put that into the environment and the context of all these other services doing things and all these other things happening, you end up with this kind of fight for resources, right?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, it's not a good idea to do this work proactively, especially if the device is upstairs. So I can definitely see how it's a challenge building something like this. And, you know, you kind of need to have good orchestration of tasks, I feel like, in a project like this where it's almost like an operating system, right?
Yeah.
Where each app or each subsystem cannot just do whatever it wants. It needs to ask for permission, which as third-party developers on iOS, sometimes we find annoying, but it's kind of a necessity when you're building something as complex as an IDE or as an operating system in order to have good scheduling of tasks.
Yeah, and in the case of Xcode, maybe this particular problem, and maybe even like the editor lag we were talking about, could actually be improved by making it even more modular, where you do all of this device management stuff on a completely separate process. A lot of it already happens on a separate process, but not all of it. So there's still a lot that Xcode does within the Xcode process itself and the code editor as well. So everything is running in this shared thread pool. So maybe this should be a separate thing that runs on an extension. And of course, that can introduce its own problems. So it's nothing is perfect, basically.
Yeah, and I've been thinking quite a lot about this recently, actually, especially in the context of Swift and the main actor, where I feel like one kind of blessing and a curse of apps on Apple's platforms is this like main thread synchronization problem slash good thing.
Right.
Which what I mean by that is that, you know, a lot of the things that happen in an application are synchronized on the main thread. Like all the UI runs on the main thread for like the most part. You have the main thread usually hold a lot of data and state related to the UI, but also, you know, maybe coordinating access to certain resources like the file system or databases, not running the queries or things on the main thread, but actually just going through to make sure, you know, that there are not data races in there and making sure that everything is updated predictably in a predictable order. If you just analyze like any given application of any size, the amount of work that happens on the main thread, I would say, is quite large, right?
Yep.
Even if you're taking a lot of work to split things up on multiple threads and really run things in parallel, you still have that main thread that is like the core of the application. And I feel like that's kind of also an issue with systems like this, where even if you do separate it out and you do run it in the background and you do maybe run it on a different process, like you still have to kind of go back to that main thread and jump over all the time to update the UI, to maybe check in from some other service. And that needs to be synchronized to the main thread in order to be predictable. And you end up with this like a bottleneck, essentially, with the main thread. And I've been doing some prototyping recently, maybe going to talk about that on a future episode, but related to this, where I've been thinking about like, what would it be like if an application did not have that main thread concept, but rather was just completely distributed on different actors and different threads. And that, of course, has other problems, but it's just, you know, it's interesting that this legacy of the main thread on Apple's platforms, which has existed for years and years, is something that sometimes gets in the way of really trying to parallelize things and distribute them, you know, across threads and processes.
Yeah, especially when you consider, which is not something you have to consider very frequently, especially for beginners, but I think every iOS developer or Mac developer who's been doing stuff on the platforms for as long as we have, at least, you also have to consider that the main queue also has a run loop, which
right.
you do not get by default on background threads, any other queue, basically, that's not the main queue. So sometimes there are APIs that will not work if they are dispatched to another queue. And if you don't know about the run loop and you don't know that that particular API requires an active run loop, you are in for a lot of debugging because things are just not going to work.
Yeah, exactly. And then you end up having to go back to synchronize on the run loop, and that introduces like this bottleneck. And it's interesting because sometimes you can end up with, especially when you're working with things like Swift concurrency, when you're just like dispatching tasks and you are, you can end up in a situation where you think you're writing very concurrent code, but it's actually not concurrent really, because it has to go back and synchronize on the main thread. And that means that even if you have 1,000 tasks running, if they all need to talk to the main thread throughout the task, well, they're all going to be scheduled on top of each other on that main thread. So they might be asynchronous, but they might not be fully concurrent.
Yep.
And yeah, it's just kind of interesting to think about.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, Rambo. So we've talked about AI a bit on this episode so far, and you alluded to that you've been doing some work around this. And I know that we've talked about it before on the show, and you've shared some things with me as well. So I kind of know a little bit what you're up to, but I'm really curious to hear more, and I'm sure that our listeners are as well. So could you first perhaps just give us a bit of a recap around how you are currently kind of integrating different AI features into the projects you work on? And expand a little bit more on kind of your overall strategy there, apart from the thing we discussed about earlier around, you know, perhaps using something that Apple will offer or something, you know, from OpenAI and so on. So tell us a bit about your AI adventures.
Right. Yeah. So like I mentioned, for Chibi Studio, we've been doing a bunch of work, mostly around understanding the contents of images and also the opposite, which is generating images and even combining both. Where basically, it's basically a fancy style transfer, if you think about it. So there are these ML models called style transfer models, where you basically take an image and you run it through the model and it spits out the same image, but in a different style. So you can think like of training one of these models using paintings from a specific artist, and then kind of like the texture of the painting is transferred to the image that you put in. So that's a style transfer model. And you can train those very easily using like CreateML on your Mac, and they run pretty quickly on the neural engine, and they are usually fairly small. So that's very basic. But you can do something like that with something like the GPT-4 Vision model from OpenAI, where you take an image and you instruct the model to describe in as much detail as possible that image. And then you add another prompt where you say, okay, now generate another image as described above, but in the style of a 3D movie or something. And then you can be as creative as you want with the description of the style. And you basically get, like in the case of Chibi Studio, we can send it an image of this 2D, very cartoony kind of character that the person has created in the app, and then have it describe the character, like the hairstyle, the clothing, colors, things like that, and tell ChatGPT, and then it will generate a prompt to DALL-E, which is yet another model, but an image generation model, and it will like create a version of your character that instead of being this cartoon 2D character, looks like 3D or looks like a real person or something like that.
That's super cool. And on a technical level then, it sounds like you're doing something similar to what we discussed earlier, which is like combining generative AI with known metadata, because presumably you are generating these descriptions and so on based on the items that the user has picked in the UI, and you know what those items are. So you know if this is like pink hair or a black t-shirt or jeans and so on, and you could then like generate the descriptions for that based on that. Is that kind of how it works?
We can use that to augment the description. So the main description is completely based on the image itself. So GPT-4 Vision, it can basically, you give it an image file and it will describe what's in the image. Of course, in order to get it to describe it in the way you want and with the level of detail you want and like what type of features do you want it to focus on, then you have to basically steer the model by basically telling it what to do, which I think I've mentioned here before. It's kind of like programming in a sense. I'm not treating the model like I'm chatting to someone in this case. I'm basically treating it as a programming language. So
right.
Instead of doing like statements and commands, it's just phrases in English. And they don't have to be in English necessarily, which is really cool, but in our case it is. And I'm also, like I mentioned before, completely abstracting all of this stuff, and the user doesn't even have to know that this is using OpenAI or whatever. And that's also in preparation for maybe Apple does something like this, and then we basically plug this into Apple's backend, and the user doesn't have to know about it. However, we are doing some of what you mentioned where, yes, we know since you create your character by selecting from pre-made items, we know that there are items, that this item is hair or is clothing, and we also know which item pack it's from, so maybe that can hint to a theme if you have many items from the fantasy pack. Maybe you want the image to be more fantasy focused. So we can basically take those inputs and send them to the model in the way of keywords so that it can steer its description more towards those aspects. And one very important aspect that we found out is difficult to get the model to describe just based on the image is skin color. And that's, of course, very important because we allow, of course, people to change the skin color of their character. And what I found during initial testing was that the model basically ignores the skin color. It doesn't include that in the description. Even if you say very explicitly, like, please remember to include the skin color of the character in the description, it does not do it. So,
and you even ask nicely by saying please.
Please, yeah, or offer it a reward. Like, I'll give you $10 if you include this. That's actually a technique you can use with these models, which is crazy. But
that's funny. I hope that they're not keeping track of that on the OpenAI side, and then they send you a bill for millions of dollars that you've promised the OpenAI, you know, AI to give them.
That would be bad. Yeah, so... So basically what we do in terms of the skin color is we know what parts of what items represent the body and the face, and we know if you have customized the color, and if you have customized the color, we know what color it is. So that is also given as input, and that was the only way we found to actually get it to not forget about the skin color of the character.
Yeah, that's really interesting, and it feels like that's a common theme with these AI models that they have a difficulty with for various reasons, like humans, all the different shapes and sizes and forms and colors that humans take on, right?
Yep.
Like there's been so many problems with that with models already, and you know that's probably going to be a challenge going forward as well. It's really interesting to hear you talk about this and like this combination again of like manually added data and derived from the model, not the data, like not the AI model, but the data model in the app, right? Like your actual metadata, and then like actually running the prompt and running the vision as well. Like it's really cool to see all those things combined into like a single product. And I'm wondering like a little bit here, if I can take a little bit of a sidestep here, which is like, if you think about how AI might fit into software development overall going forward, not just like in terms of offering products to end users, but how we might interact with it as developers, I'm thinking that perhaps something like what you're doing right now will be something that we will do way more as like our day-to-day work as developers. And what I mean by that is if you think about something like a Swift UI view, for example, right? Which is where you just declare, I want this to be a button, I want this to be a text, and so on. That is a lot more higher level than if you would write the same thing in UIKit with kind of imperative commands, yep. right? Where you would say like, you know, let UI button and you will set the constraints on it and so on and so forth. And I feel like AI is like one step further or perhaps multiple steps further up that abstraction chain. And perhaps we will have something in the future, perhaps sooner rather than later, where we can describe the UIs we want to render, for example, with natural language, but then interject specific commands, specific programmatic code into that that would then do specific tweaks, right? Yeah. So if it's able to generate like a list from a JSON file in a very straightforward way, but you want to customize how the rows look in, like what the disclosure indicator will look like or something like that, you could then inject that specific override to say, you know, actually, I want the disclosure indicator to be exactly this UI code, and you would then override that. What do you think about this idea? Do you feel like that's something that could actually happen?
Yeah, I do think that it could happen, and it is something I've done using like Visual Studio Code when I'm doing like JavaScript or TypeScript stuff, where I use Copilot, and it's not uncommon that I will think through a problem. So basically like, oh, I need a function to do whatever, and then I think about the problem in the way I would think about it if I wrote the function, and instead of just thinking about it, I actually write it down as a comment in the JavaScript file or whatever, and then I press enter and Copilot writes the function, basically the first version of the function, because it's rarely the case that you can just use its code as is, but frequently it gets you going in the right direction, especially if you're not as familiar with the environment and the programming language. Like, I am fairly decent with TypeScript and JavaScript, but there are still some things I don't really know how to do sometimes, and then I can just ask Copilot. And it's basically the same thing I would be doing if I was using, like, Google or DuckDuckGo to search, but I feel like it keeps me in the flow of coding, because context switching is really bad for me. Like, I don't really do well with switching between a lot of different things at the same time. So just having to switch between my editor, my IDE, and Safari or something to Google or search for something, that kind of breaks the flow a little bit. So being able to ask the question in line and have an answer in there, or if it's more complex, there's even like this little sidebar now in VS Code where you can basically chat with Copilot and then it can give you code snippets. And oftentimes, if I don't like the initial offering that it renders for me, I can delete that and give a little bit more guidance. Like instead of, oh, I don't want you to use this API, I want you to use this other one instead, and then you can do it with the API you mentioned. Or you write parts of the code and it can fill in the rest. And especially with repetitive code, like sometimes there's code that's just repetitive. It's just boring. It's just a bunch of code that you have to write, like a bunch of boilerplate. And I find that Copilot is really good at filling that in. Like you give it two or three examples and then it can do the rest for you. So it's basically a very advanced version of autocomplete.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. That's really, really useful right now. But what's interesting is that is very much like an kind of offline process, right? That happens during the development. And yep. the artifact of that is still source code. But what I find interesting to think about is some potential future where the artifact is not source code, but rather like an actual prompt that you will check into your GitHub repo and that will be run at runtime and resolved by the system. And it can include like mixes of like either imperative or declarative code, but it's like a combination and that gets resolved at runtime. And that sounds, I think, kind of scary when you think about it. Like you just like ship a prompt and hope the best will happen on the user's device. But that's kind of what we're doing with SwiftUI, right? Like you are not coding the pixels for this button that you just created. You are just saying button. And then what will actually be rendered is up to each user's device and the frameworks running locally on those devices. So again, like this idea of having an AI kind of built UI that you've just described locally as a developer, not just with like something like Copilot, but you've actually like shipped the prompt. Like that I feel like is like just a few levels up on that abstraction chain. And it's just kind of interesting to think about that maybe that's going to be the way we program, especially UIs, like in a few years from now. Like it's kind of wild.
Yeah. Now that you mentioned, one place where I feel like that could start out is something like shortcuts, right? You have people like Vitici making these really advanced shortcuts to a point where he's basically a developer right now, and his programming right. language of choice is shortcuts. And there is no built-in way in shortcuts right now for you as the creator of a shortcut to basically create little pieces of UI. There are certain actions, like you can ask for text input, you can ask for photos, but you can't like create a form with checkboxes and pop-ups and things like that. So I wonder if that could be the first place where this sort of thing could show up, where you basically write a description of the UI you want in within the shortcut and what inputs and outputs you want from it. And at runtime, it basically generates the UI for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I could totally see something like that happening. And I want to emphasize that it's not that I'm saying that I'm hoping that this will happen, because I do also find this scary.
Yeah.
Like, but if you think about it, like if you chart the progress of software development, like from the, let's say, 1950s till today, like what has kept happening is that you leverage some kind of system more and more, and you work at a higher level of abstraction.
Yep.
So, you know, very few people these days are writing like assembly code directly, and fewer people are writing like lower level languages like C, for example. And a lot of development has moved to more higher level languages like JavaScript, like you mentioned, or Swift, or Python, or other things that are like more higher level, running in some kind of either like a runtime or some kind of managed environment, or it compiles down to machine code or assembly code or C or something like that. So, you know, if you look at it from that lens, like writing a prompt is really just like a different kind of compiler that is being run through, right?
Yep.
And you're just getting a different kind of result and you're working at a different kind of higher level. And I just find it fascinating to think about that, you know, especially when we're talking about what will the future of programming look like? Like, will it be just like increasingly higher level languages, or will it be more like declarative programming, more like things like Swift UI and Jetpack Compose on Android, or will it be more towards like the AI side of things and with prompts? And yeah, I really don't know where the future will go, but it's going to be interesting to find out for sure.
Absolutely.
And I think that's a good place to wrap up this episode. So thanks so much for listening, everybody. And we will try to talk to you again soon. We'll probably do an episode like right after WWDC, right, Rambo?
Definitely.
We have to do some kind of reaction there to see what actually happened and how much of AI did we actually see. How many times did Tim Cook say the word AI throughout the keynote? That's going to be the most interesting to find
out. Yeah, from the recent iPad event, I think it was like 10 times. So not that many, but it was just like 30 minutes. So we'll see. I suspect at WW it will be way more.
Yeah, and I mean, just think about how many times we've said it throughout this episode, right? Like it's one of those things you can easily do super cuts of, right? Where you're just like AI, AI, AI. It's all very funny. So we'll talk to you then. And until then, say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.